Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And this hour, why this reckoning on sexual harassment must go deep in the American workplace. Me Too put names and faces on the Wall Street executives, the politicians, the actors, the journalists who use their power to prey on women. But what's happening with the factory foremen, the farm owners, the retail shop managers who have gotten away with this behavior for years? Journalists Susan Chira and Katrin Einhorn give us a detailed and startling look in a mid-December story in the New York Times at what women have been subjected to for decades in Ford's Chicago automotive plants. Crass comments, soliciting sex for promotions, humiliating graffiti, and a union that was mostly missing in action. As the story rightly asserts, much less attention has been focused on the plight of the blue-collar workers like those on Ford's factory floors. The women who are leading change in Hollywood understand that, too. Their new Time's Up movement is joining with groups like Alianza Nacional de Campesinas for Advocate for farm-working women. Today, that's what our show is about, how to change the culture in industries that are male-dominated or workplaces in which women struggle to wield any kind of power. So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. Do you work in the service industry or retail or some other kind of blue-collar work where the harassment is particularly blatant? Do you feel empowered to speak up about it or not? Do you see change coming to your workplace? So I'd like to hear from you if you're in the retail business, the service industry. Maybe you work in a manufacturing plant, some kind of blue-collar work where harassment has been rampant for a long time. Does change feel like it's coming there? Do you now feel empowered to speak up about it? 651-227-6000. If you're outside of the region and listening in, 800-242-2828. And of course, you can talk to me about it on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and you can remain anonymous if you'd like as you call in. Our guest today, Susan Chira, is with us. She's senior correspondent on gender issues at the New York Times. I've tweeted a link to her December story, and she's with us from New York. And Susan, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Carla Altmaier is with us. She's a lawyer and co-founder of Healing to Action. It's an organization that works to end workplace violence, and she's with us from Chicago. And Carla, welcome to you. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
You know, Susan, I think something that an employment attorney from Pittsburgh told you is going to resonate through the hour. Megan Block said to you, a lot of these blue-collar women, they suffer in silence. They don't have the choice. They don't have the money. They don't have the time. And I think that was really evident in the stories you were telling about the Ford plants. Would you expand a bit on that?
Yes, I think that's very important. You know, traditionally it's been very hard for blue-collar women to find recourse. They need these jobs. These jobs, if you look at the Ford Chicago plants, but, you know, many, many other similar jobs across the country, these are really well-paying jobs with good benefits that are very hard to find in today's economy. And I think that a lot of people shut up because they were really afraid they wouldn't be believed. They were afraid, justifiably it turned out, of retaliation from coworkers and in some cases bosses. And they really didn't have the money to hire high-priced lawyers to fight their cases. So all these factors conspire to have women put up with it.
And just to make the distinction here, Susan, when we heard about Hollywood, Wall Street, even though those women did not feel empowered at the time to speak out about it, many were able to say, well, I won't work with that director anymore, or I won't, you know, collaborate with that journalist anymore. In a way, perhaps, that I hear the storytelling around blue-collar work being different.
I think that's right. I mean, in other words, you know, say you're in a factory or you're bagging groceries. You know, you're stuck with that boss, and there aren't as many jobs for you to quit and go find. And particularly in the case of the better-paying manufacturing jobs, you cannot make that salary elsewhere. And these are jobs that are hold a shrinking place in the American economy. You know, under increasing international competition, wages have been driven down. Mm-hmm. So there aren't as many jobs that pay you so well. You know, these women at Ford were very, very grateful for these jobs. And they put their kids through college. In many cases, women were single breadwinners. Not in many cases, they were married to other men who worked at Ford, too. And, you know, we knew college-educated women who had chosen factory work over teaching because it paid so much better.
Carla, I want to grab a call here real quick before I come to you on that, to Lucy in Duluth. Lucy, it sounds like you've had some experience with this, yes?
Well, yeah, it's a topic near and dear to my heart because now I'm in, you know, well-educated women, blah, 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 going on to other things. But in the 70s, I was the 17th bus driver at the old MTC, now Metro Transit. Mm-hmm. And without giving you my life history, I'll just say I was raised by parents who did not treat me like I was made out of glass, encouraged me to do all kinds of things with the boys. They'd hoped I'd be a judge. Instead, I took my liberal arts education and became a bus driver. But though message I always got was, if you're going to play with the boys, you better expect to take your knocks like the boys, which wasn't the worst advice you could give a girl in those ages. But when I arrived at the Metro Transit, and there was tremendous backlash against women, mostly on the part of mechanics, we would be cornered in deep, dark bays. We would find dog feces on our seats. It was horrendous. And when we went to management, the message we got was, well, you don't want to destroy a good man's reputation when it involved a supervisor at high levels. That whole concept that I still struggle with, even within the last few years, I bragged to a guy that was dating, I'm now in my 60s, to say, you know, you got to look for those girls that were raised by brothers. We're tough. We know how to take our knocks. That women ourselves, we have to accept that, no, they don't get to make the world and these terrible experiences. I would encourage people to watch an old movie that starred Charlize Theron called North Country, I believe, that dealt with women on the Iron Range.
Carla, I love your thoughts on what Lucy says about knowing you're going into a male-dominated field and knowing that means you're going to have to be tough, but then also feeling that rebellion around, why do they get to decide what this workplace is going to be and why do I have to be subjected to that?
I think for a lot of people, I think we have to remember that workers who are earning, you know, minimum wage or a little over minimum wage, who are living paycheck to paycheck, they are not necessarily going into thinking, oh, I have to go into this male-dominated industry. They're thinking, I have to put food on the table. I have to pay my bills. I have to take care of my family. And when this happens in the workplace, I think what ends up happening is people are considering this as like, this is just a part of the job. I think when, you know, we see the visibility now of farm worker women in the public, and it's important to recognize that for many years, farm workers just thought that, you know, the field itself was called the field of panties. That was the name for it. And it was called that because it was just assumed that sexual harassment would happen in the workplace. So it was just accepted and tolerated as a part of the culture.
Susan called in to say, in 1987, I was offered a job in New York working for a landscaping firm. Gave up my whole life to go there. Within 3 months, the owner started to sexually harass me. One day, put his hands down my pants. I had nowhere to go. To the phones here to Abby in Minneapolis. Abby, what's your experience been with this?
Hi, Hi. As a college student, I was manufacturing snowblowers as my summer part-time job. Mm-hmm. And we had a bunch of college girls on our line who were continuously harassed by, in particular, one gentleman on our line. A gentleman is a stretch. You would say comments to us such as, "Ooh, I love the way you swing that hammer. Can you hammer me like that later this evening?" And that was a mild comment. We repetitively complained about this particular individual to our foremen, to our other folks on the line, and he never got fired until he actually ran over the foot of a woman he was harassing with a forklift.
Tell me what the bosses would say, Abby, when you and others would go to complain about him.
I mean, it was a good old boys club. It was, oh, he'll, you know, that's just the way things are, or, you know, we've got a 3-strike policy here, and that's only strike one, despite all of us complaining. I mean, we had 4 girls on my line, and all 4 of us complained. I don't understand how that could be less than 3 strikes.
Wow. Really glad you called, because I wanted to talk about this with Susan. Susan, you heard at the Ford plants and from other women who are doing blue-collar work that they are often told, as we've already heard, you really want to take down some guy's career over this? Is it really that big of a deal? What did the women tell you about that?
Yes, we heard very consistently from women. Both, one thing I should explain to our listeners is the history of these 2 plants at Ford is quite fascinating in Chicago, because there are lawsuits and EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, investigations, you know, 20, 25 years apart. And so this behavior was going on. So for both from women in the 90s and from women contemporaneously, we heard that a number of union officials discouraged them from reporting. You're going to hurt, you know, Bill's career. You know, you really want to cause him to lose his pension? This really isn't a big deal. Why are you making such a fuss? Now, there were definitely union officials who were terrific and who jumped on it and helped them file complaints, but they got a lot of resistance. And unions play a very conflicted role in this kind of harassment, because they have their obligation to protect the men who are accused as well as the women who are making the accusations, and so they're often torn.
And Carla, so people wonder why women don't report it. I mean, this is what strikes me about all of these accounts, is women become very accustomed to making instant risk assessment right in the moment. The harassment happens. A woman has to say, what am I going to do about this? And go through the whole scenario very quickly about how this could play out, and often decides it's not worth it.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, women are in a position where they're having to balance and weigh what is the benefit of coming forward and reporting it. And I've seen in many cases when the reporting happens when there is a risk to the person's job, mm-hmm. or to their own physical safety. And I think for some of these cases, especially in the Ford plant, you did see that women did report it. But the response that they got, and that is also another part that discourages other women from coming forward, is when they hear the response of saying, well, maybe you should think about this. Maybe it's on you, as the person who's experienced this violence, to really risk, do this assessment, rather than us as an employer or us as a human resources department to really do our work of investigating and actually following through with accountability measures.
Yeah, Susan, why did you just say that the unions play a really conflicted role in this? What's the reason for that?
The reason is that unions represent all the employees. So when someone is accused of sexual harassment, unions also represent them. In many cases, the same union representative will be handling the man who's accused and denies it and the woman who's accusing. So they are torn between, you know, these groups. And that has created, you know, according to many, many employment attorneys and union folks I talk to, this is an issue for unions in many workplaces.
conversation this morning, if you've just gotten in with us, about sexual harassment and Me Too in blue-collar work, in the service industry, the retail industry, factory work, where harassment is especially blatant. Susan Shearer from the New York Times and a colleague wrote a terrific piece in mid-December about what's been going on at the Ford plant. Lawsuits 25 years ago, the harassment continues to today. I've tweeted a link to the piece. And Carla Altmaier is with us from as co-founder and an attorney of Healing to Action. I want to hear from you. If you work in retail, if you work in the service at restaurant bars, I worked in restaurants and bars for years right out of college, during college. Do you feel empowered to speak up about the harassment that you encounter? Do you see change coming just in the last few months since such a spotlight has been put on sexual harassment? Do you sense change happening? 651-227-6000 and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR, where a listener tweeted just a few minutes ago that the United States Postal Service has a serious sexual harassment problem in management. Listener says, happened at my station. The manager got shuffled around as a punishment. And then another listener here, Rich, says, important to your topic, the owner of my blue-collar workplace refuses to hire a woman for fear of a sexual harassment lawsuit instead of just holding the men who work there accountable. I mean, Carla, this is exactly what women fear too, right? If they come forward and talk about this, it will close the door to their own opportunities and opportunities for other women.
That's absolutely right. And that is a fear that women do have, that it can happen in their workplace. I think especially for women who are entering male-dominated industries, so we're thinking about industries like the trades, where that is a male-dominated field, women who enter there as apprentices are really confronted with that on a daily basis. I've heard one worker tell me how her placement with the steel workers was initially denied because they didn't want to have a woman in the field because they knew what would happen to her. But that fear, I just want to point out that fear has existed before this moment.
That's right.
And it's always been there. And so it's just now what really needs to be happening is a conversation of how can we create an environment where everyone feels welcome and everyone can work with dignity.
And just to put a point on that, this, if you haven't seen the open letter that the Farm Workers Organization wrote in the wake of the Hollywood allegations, it says this in part: like you, there are few positions available to us, and reporting any kind of harm or injustice committed against us doesn't seem like a viable option. Complaining about anything, even sexual harassment, seems unthinkable because too much is at risk, including the ability to feed our families and preserve our reputations. To the phones here to Jamie in Minneapolis. Jamie, what's your experience been with this?
Hi, yes. So I have always worked in restaurants part-time, kind of to put myself through college and then to make extra money. It's just been kind of one of those things that is accepted in the restaurant industry where men will make sexually explicit comments to you, whether it comes from a manager or from customers. And when it comes from customers, if you complain to a manager or try to speak to them about it, they just kind of brush it off and, oh, this is the industry we're in. And if you were to say something about a manager sexually harassing you, it would be kind of joked off that this is the industry we're in and that it should be accepted because this is what we chose. And for me, it's kind of been a struggle my whole restaurant career just in dealing with that because it's not something that I do accept. And just speaking to other people in the restaurant industry, actually when the Me Too happened, we talked about it and we talked about, you know, are we going to see change in the restaurant industry? And everyone was like, no, I don't think we're going to because this is just how it is. And I've been in it for 10 years and nothing has ever changed. And I actually saw a manager who was very sexually explicit move up in ranks and become a regional manager. And it was just, it was really, really hard to see. So,
yeah, I mean, Jamie, my experience was an attitude of, if you can't deal with it, go find somewhere else to work.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. Yes.
You know,
very
Susan,
frustrating.
Thanks for the call. Susan, I'm curious. I know you've been hearing from a number of women in different industries. Are you hearing from women in the restaurant business who are saying the same thing that Jamie is?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we at the Times and many of other news organizations have also, you know, published a lot of riveting accounts of the restaurant industry and the kind of abuse that's been rampant. On the Times' restaurant critic, I think, wrote a really fascinating piece sort of calling on people in the restaurant industry to try to take some action. And but I think that one of the things that across industries that have common is this sense, you tough it out. Be tough enough to take it. You can deal with this.
Right.
I think that's really an ethos that I see a lot. And a lot of women we even talk to, they would say things like us, hey, there's no sexual harassment. I just tell them, I won't play. Like, it was really kind of fascinating. There's no sexual harassment. They're like dogs, but you just got to know how to get them off you. So, like, in some ways, sometimes women internalize this and think, oh, it's my fault. I can't handle it. I can't take care of it by myself. Whereas, in fact, they're not in a position of power to take care of it by themselves. Because men are in charge of them, men affect their lives, and coworkers can put them at risk and make their lives a living hell. So I think, you know, as many people have said, it's really important to figure out where do you go where you get redress. And when we looked at Ford, I think that, you know, one of the issues that was brought up in our discussion is that the HR department did investigate, but they also faced a problem that there's a kind of he said, she said problem. In many cases, sexual harassment doesn't have witnesses, or witnesses are too intimidated to come forward. So there's also a question of how do you verify this stuff? How do you make it clear that it won't be tolerated? How do you up the risk for engaging this activity in the first place?
Good point. That's where there's power in numbers, isn't there, Susan? If you can get enough of your fellow workers to band together, but as each one of them has to assess the risk for themselves, that's tough too.
Yes, it's very hard. A number of women who spoke out publicly have gotten enormous, terrible pushback. You know, threats, slash tires. You know, statements like "you're raping the company." People are afraid the plants will shut down.
Jeez.
They're accused of sleeping around and being sluts. There's all kinds of things that women encounter who speak out. And one of the things we did in our reporting is that we talked to more than 70 workers, most of whom were too frightened, frankly, to give their names, but who echoed what the women told us publicly. These women and men who had witnessed it told us anonymously. So we felt more comfortable in the depth of our reporting that this was, in fact, going on and not confined to some malcontents
right.
who are out to make a buck, which is how many people characterize the women who speak out.
Carla, I want you to hear a tweet here from Pete, and I suspect that there are probably a number of men who won't call the show, maybe some women who won't call the show, but believe this. He says, this isn't violence. This isn't harassment. This is how guys talk on the job site. You should hear the things we call each other. It's not a big deal. What would you say to that?
Well, I think what's interesting is we've had a culture of masculinity for a really long time in some of these workplaces where he's right. That is how they're talking. That is how they're coexisting. That doesn't make it okay. And that doesn't mean that it isn't violent. There are men who have also reported experiencing sexual harassment, and it took years before the EEOC recognized that same-sex harassment does exist. And ultimately, what we are, you know, we need to think about what kind of norms are we pushing for in the workplace? And when someone doesn't conform to that, then they are experiencing a punishment. The punishment is either through being bullied, or what we call bullying, harassment, or physical assaults. So, you know, that, again, just because it's something that has happened doesn't make it okay.
Susan, what would you say about that? I don't know how – I want to be persuasive on this for listeners who are saying women just have to figure out how to take it. This is the environment. Deal with it.
Right. Well, I think there are several issues. You know, as you were just saying, I think it's very important to make the point that bullying behavior of all kinds can spill over to harassing behavior. This is – clearly established in all kinds of studies and people's experience. And why do we want a workplace when people are cruel to each other?
Now, right.
However, there is a certain amount of good-natured banter. And I think that you can make a distinction between a kind of good-natured teasing and teasing that's out there to humiliate and degrade and make you feel uncomfortable and make you feel unwanted. And I think that difference is very clear to people who experience it. Because, you know, kidding around, yes, that can slide into a bad place. But when people have power over you or when people are using it to make you uncomfortable and don't stop when it makes you uncomfortable, this is taking on a menacing edge. And I think, yes, I understand that these cultures have been there for a long time, but those cultures are not necessarily healthy. And just as you were saying, you know, we did a lot of searches of lawsuits, and we came across lawsuits in which men who were somehow perceived as effeminate, whether they were gay or not gay, were tortured in these workplaces too because they didn't fit some ideal of the tough guy. You know, these workplaces should be places where anyone can work in comfort, earn their money, do their job right.
And Carla, just another note here before we take another call. How about workplaces where women feel empowered to say, you know, that's not cool, cut it out. And aren't going to get retaliation just in the you should hear what guys say to each other. I'm not talking about the some of the other kinds of harassment, but just in that atmosphere to be able to feel like you could say, I don't want to hear that. I don't want you to say that to me. A lot of women swallow that. They don't even feel empowered to be able to say that.
That's true. And again, this goes to a culture, right, where there's this toxic masculinity that's really setting what the norm is for that industry. It's not going to just by placing one woman in power, that's not going to change this culture.
Right.
It requires intentional, open conversations where everyone is really working to come to a consensus of what is acceptable behavior that allows people to work with dignity in the workplace.
I want to take a call here from someone who'd like to be anonymous in Stillwater. Hi, really appreciate you calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's your story?
I work in a mainly male-dominated corrections.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is there an onslaught of, you know, sexual harassment from the offenders, but there's locker room talk between guys, and I mean, and we're expected as females, well, you're one of the guys, you're in this male-dominated, you know, career path, but, you know, it's kind of hard to be around it and deal with it and just suck it up. If you don't like it, there's another job out there. I think you guys touched on that before, but I've noticed in the past year, there's almost a about face where you hear more women doing the locker talk.
Really?
And, yeah, and you hear it anywhere going out with friends and how girls talk. So it's kind of, I don't know, we've kind of reversed everything, it almost feels like. And now it's acceptable for women to do it, but not men.
I'm curious about what would happen if, you know, day to day, you called some of the men on the talk. If you just turned around and said, you know, I don't want to hear that. Don't say that to me. Hmm. What, could you do it or no?
Around here, I mean, especially now, like I said, the past year is very different. Now, you know, you feel more empowered to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think more of the males now they don't feel like they can say it. Like, hey, you guys, knock it off, or, you know, I don't need to listen to that kind of stuff.
You know, I appreciate the call. I was just, Carla, I was giving some thought to what she said about women taking on these personas, because that's the way, I guess, you survive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've heard countless of women say, well, I've been able to say no, and they've left me alone. But I, you know, again, kind of what Susan said is that it ignores that there's a systemic problem because that person is then going to go to someone else who can't say no. And maybe they can't say no because they are really dependent on that job. They're a single parent. Maybe they're undocumented. And then what? Right. I think it also it really does require not just women to come to say no, but men, too. Men need to be able to stand up to other men and say no.
Call here from Dan. Oh, Susan, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
That's all right.
I was thinking that as you were speaking, so I'm really glad. I think it's really important that we understand that this cannot change unless men speak up and men say to other men, hey, you're out of line.
Call here from Eric in Minneapolis. Eric, I think that's what you wanted to talk about, right? How men work with other men on this.
That's exactly my comment, is that if this is going to change, it's going to change not only for, you know, supervisors and coworkers and women. It has to change for men, and men cannot tolerate this, whether we're 65 or 25 or anywhere in between. There are some things that are simply not allowed. It's respect and dignity for human beings, and if we respect each other, we do, and if we don't, then we're savage barbarians. So if you want to be treated well, treat people well, and, you know, walk into every situation as if you're talking to your father, your mother, your sister, your brother, or your children.
Okay, so Eric, thank you. We want to play some of the voices that came into the Susan Chira and her colleague and to the New York Times from women who work in blue-collar fields about what they've experienced. So this is the sound of women talking about what it's like, specifically Ford plant women, about what it's like on the job.
I was propositioned. I slept with him because I needed my job. I had small children.
I got the text messages. Come over here right now. Take a picture of your boobs for me. Get over here.
Every time I would have a new instance of something sexual happened, it just felt like more of me diminishing, just getting smaller until it was just like a shell of a person.
Susan, that is just wrenching, feeling like a shell of a person. And I know that's just a fraction of the voices that you heard.
Yeah, it was. That was Suzette Wright, who was in the first lawsuit at Ford back in the 90s in Chicago, and several of the other voices were from the current legal case that's wending its way through the courts. We heard so many stories that were extraordinary, and when women told them to us, it was as if they were reliving that trauma. Many broke down, many got very quiet, many struggled with the impact of it, because I think what's less well known is that, you know, when you are harassed like this over and over and you don't feel hope of change, it certainly, some of the women that we talked to had really suffered with, you know, severe depression and anxiety. So it really leaves a toll, and I think it also leaves a longer-term economic toll. In some cases, if women are driven out of these professions, if they leave these jobs, it's very hard to find a similarly well-paying job again that can affect your whole financial trajectory in life.
I will say that in the piece, you are singling out some of the men, including a couple of the men in the union, who tried to step in to help, who were trying to change the culture. This goes to what we were talking about before news, about how we must enlist men in this too. What kind of conclusions do you draw from the reporting you've done on that?
I was really struck by the fact that there were men who were really quite brave and very strong and were disgusted by this behavior, and they called out their colleagues and they helped the women. They were an ear to listen, and in many cases they would intervene and say, why are you doing this? Cut it out. Or they'd say to the women, go and complain. I'll back you up. I'll be your witness. And, you know, those are the men, and I talked to many of those men who I think, you know, really feel, and many of them put it in a way that I think many men can relate to. What if that was my daughter or my wife? Now, would I want them talked to that way? Or, you know, there's just no excuse for this kind of behavior. So, you know, I have hope that you know, there's some ability for people to say enough. And, you know, we talked to a number of men, both in the union in official capacity and just workers who were watching something that disgusted and shocked them.
So let me put out a call one more time here to listeners, to men who have witnessed this in your workplace, and whether you feel empowered to step up and call your colleagues on it and support women who are clearly uncomfortable, and where there's a situation where the law is clearly being broken on this. Do you feel empowered to step in, to talk to your colleagues about it, to support women who are going to complain about it? I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. 651-227-6000 and on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Joe says, to all men, this is an outdated mode of thinking that never should have existed in the first place. It ends now. To Michelle in Minneapolis. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. Yes, I recently moved back to the Twin Cities from Madison, Wisconsin, where I worked in the public school. I experienced sexual harassment there by two separate men and reported it two times within 1 year, and it was my first year working in the school. I'm just one woman in one school. I reported it to a strong female principal, and I was represented by a union rep who represented me and the man that was sexually harassing me. The principal ended up hiring him back the next year. He then was harassing another woman and finally was fired as a result of that. I had a lot less invested in the schools than people who have worked for 5, 10, 15,
right.
20 years in the schools, right? But I'm still scared to this day, even coming to a new city, have I ruined my opportunity to work in any schools?
So,
I haven't heard about people working in schools expressing this, so I just wanted to open the conversation to that.
Michelle, just a question. So the offender was hired back, as you said, by this same strong principal who supported you.
Oh, the principal didn't support, well, she was neutral, but the union representative supported both me and him. The principal acted on her own and hired him back the next year because he was in a job that was difficult to do. He was working with the neediest child in school who happened to be a young girl who couldn't speak, could barely walk, and was deaf, which was also a difficult position to put him in.
Carla, how often do you hear that the offender winds up, surviving the complaint process and staying at work or being hired back?
So many times. When I represented farm workers, that was usually what would happen, was that the employer would promote the harasser or the accused harasser or keep the accused harasser working. There was only one instance where the harasser was fired, and that was because in Illinois we have a law called the Victims Economic Safety and Security Act that requires an employer to keep survivors of all forms of gender-based violence safe in the workplace. And only because of that requirement were we able to get that harasser fired. But in almost every other instance, they still either are there or they still have power and influence over the decision of whether of what is going to happen.
Susan, that clearly came through in your Ford reporting.
Yes. Carla is making such an important point there. That was absolutely true at Ford. What we found was that many accused harassers, even those accused by multiple women over years, were not fired until some years later, and in some cases, not fired. Now, obviously, we don't know every individual investigation, what was verified and what was not verified, but the fact is what women and men, they drew the conclusion, you know what, you can get away with it. We've heard umpteen stories about this guy. He's still a supervisor. He's still working. That makes people feel like nothing will be done. And I think that a lot of the experts we talked to said that while it is not a good idea to necessarily fire anyone on the first offense or, you know, unless it's terribly egregious, because you don't want to deter people from reporting or feeling that their behavior can be corrected. But the fact is, if you don't make it clear that when you reach a certain threshold, you're out of there, it will not be taken seriously. And that is something that was absolutely an issue at the Chicago plants we saw at Ford.
Susan, so many places that the story could go. What are some of the questions that you are going to explore next in the reporting?
That's a good question. I've continued to write a little bit about issues in blue-collar manufacturing. I'm working on a piece now that I hope will appear this week or next week in our review section, which explores the whole question of why jobs seem to be seen as masculine jobs and why they have this culture of masculinity, which is something that, you know, some people mentioned that I think is really worth exploring. And we're getting a lot of tips about harassment in a whole range of environments following on reporting that will follow up. So we'll see. I think there's a lot to do. And one of the questions also is, what's effective?
Right.
How would you change it? We're still exploring that.
Right. I'm so glad you're staying on this, and I think we really benefit from the reporting. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you both so much. Bye-bye now.
Susan Chira, senior correspondent on gender issues at the New York Times. And this Ford story that we've been talking about, if you hang out with me on Twitter, I tweeted a link to it, so you can open that up. Bridget says, I think this is smart, she says, observation, entered interviewing process too when establishing cultural fit. You might hear something like, we're a close group. Can we say anything without being offended? Well, that sounds to me like a little cue, Carla, to be wary of what's really being said there. How do you hear that?
Yeah, I find that to be an interesting way to talk about the workplace. You know, I think, you know, in Susan's piece, she talks about how the union discusses themselves as a family, right? But in a family, you're not able to really talk to your uncle in the way that you might want to talk to your uncle if he says something that's offensive. And so, a workplace needs to really create an open space where honesty is most important, where people are heard and where their experiences are validated. So, that would definitely be a red flag for me.
Julianne says on Twitter, my coworker posted a chart to track the menstrual cycles of the women on our team. To the phones to Scott in Minneapolis. Hi, Scott. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking that, well, I've been a manager for kitchens and also senior care homes for the past 10 years plus, and every year we have to take anti-harassment training, especially in a senior home setting.
Mm-hmm.
But the company I'm with right now is a restaurant, and that was part of my orientation. And it's interesting because harassment can be eyes or body language or gestures, et cetera. But from my understanding, what the sexual harassment part is that if somebody comes and says something to you about that, or you witness it, that there is no chain of command, that you should go right to the top, HR, the president, the director, the general manager, immediately with it. If you don't, then you could be considered liable for not reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, Scott, glad you brought this up, though, because I wanted to talk to Carla about the efficacy of sexual harassment training. I've seen research, Carla, that says it doesn't work. It's not really effective.
Yeah, I think for a lot of employers, you know, they see it, they understand that it's a requirement under the law, right, to be able to treat people in the workplace without discrimination. And so they provide the training, but it's not training that really explores the root causes of gender-based violence or gender disparity or inequality. It's not something that creates open dialogue. It's more they pop in a video, and then after 20 minutes, they ask if there's any questions. And that's pretty much it. And I think, you know, the caller, Scott, he mentioned something really important, is that the internal reporting requirement makes it almost impossible for workers to come forward because they are so afraid of talking to HR, their employer, who has power over their economic security.
Right.
And so when they have to, you know, putting that in conjunction with just the lack of training and even the lack of training for people who are handling those reports, there's so much more that needs to be done.
Well, and Michael says on Twitter, this kind of follows on that, the only way to solve this is to have a suite of punishments from mild to severe. Sexual harassment is a very severe crime, deserves a severe punishment, but it will only be stamped out if moderate punishments are possible. What do you think of that, the practicality of that, Carla?
I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to really talk to the people that have been most impacted by this issue, which have been the workers who experienced the sexual harassment. Again, one of the things that stands out in Susan's piece was how that the survivors themselves had ideas. They had ideas of how to combat
That's true.
Included posting it in an open space, having open conversations about this behavior and how it was not tolerated. And so if we took a moment to talk about not just accountability, but to really listen to survivors and find out what they want, we might have a wealth of ideas of how to incorporate this conversation in our everyday work.
Tony called to say men don't change the culture of their own environment. They don't police themselves, which means that they don't stand up or speak out for women. When I was a manager in the restaurant industry, I wouldn't stand for men to make offensive comments. Tony, I think that may be true in too many places, but it doesn't mean it can't happen. Doesn't mean that men cannot be encouraged and empowered to police themselves and take responsibility for the atmosphere. To the phones to Kevin in St. Paul. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. How you doing?
Doing well. What are you thinking?
Well, as I'm listening to the conversation, I think whether it's sexual harassment or other types of harassment, as managers or to make your company run well, you need to have a non-hostile work environment. And I think in a lot of cases, we wait for people to bring up issues. One of the things that I always advocated for, and I know these are sometimes difficult to do, but an anonymous employee survey type of information. We usually do those kind of things more about how the company's running, but I think you can garner a lot of information if you start asking questions from employees anonymously of, does my manager create a friendly work environment? Do I feel it's a safe and work environment? There are lots of things that can help tip off. And the reason I hit on that is through my corporate, talking a little bit about blue collar, I come from a white collar background. All the things you're talking about apply to white collar world
sure.
as well.
Absolutely.
And I've seen so many cases where even when HR is tipped off about something, I've seen cases where we've had a manager where HR will come and say, hey, you know, you're the new boss of this individual. You need to get rid of him. We've had a lot of complaints about him. And as you dig in, you come to find nobody's ever talked to this individual and explained to them that their behavior is bad. So in a lot of cases, I think you need to do that preemptive, gather information, understand what the environment looks like, and then take proactive measures to reinforce that.
Yeah, this is interesting thinking, Carla, about the anonymous surveys. Then what has to happen is something has to happen once, right? Once there's surveys and information heading to HR and to the top of the company.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we in a lot of the conversations in the couple months, we've heard about these whisper networks. They exist.
Oh, yeah. They're,
people are talking to each other about this, but it's something that maybe the higher-ups don't know or they haven't heard. And so if we're going to open up these whisper networks and make them out, make them conversations that we're having out in the open, then there better be a response and there better be accountability so that people can continue to be encouraged to come forward.
I do like what Kevin is saying about you might find out that nobody has ever confronted, nobody of authority has ever confronted the person in the organization. And I've constantly, through all these discussions we've had about this, wondered what happens at the very top of these companies? You know, did Ford, you know, somehow did the head of the CEO of Ford somehow give the impression that this was acceptable as long as cars were being made and Americans were buying them? I mean, what does what happens at the top mean about how it filters down right down to the factory floor?
I think in a lot of the cases that I worked with farm workers, so when you're talking about farm workers, they are, you know, they are really large multi-billion dollar companies that
right.
then hire a subcontractor. And that's usually the defense that they say. They say, I didn't know that this happened. But The reality is that they did know, because in some of, you know, for some of these bad actors, they are bad actors who have had prior complaints. The question that these employers are asking, that the higher ups are asking, and what's my cost benefit analysis? They're doing one too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important, you know, it speaks volumes when they are not taking action to hold people accountable. And when they do, that will really also trickle down.
Carla, really grateful for your time and your insight on this. Thanks much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Carla Altmaier is a lawyer. She's co-founder of Healing to Action. It's an organization that works to end gender-based violence. And by the way, if you just got in on the end of this discussion, good insight. You can find it on the podcast.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.